Hello, everyone. My name is Francis Donald, and I'd like to welcome you to this 19th session in an ongoing series of webinars on sacred number and geometry. The first 18 sessions are available on makara.us. You can use the link you see on your screen to go directly to the Makara archives. I'll leave this link up for the next few slides in case you'd like to copy it down. If you have any questions about the GoToMeeting interface, feel free to text BL. If you'd like to add your name to the list of readers, then I encourage you to do this because we have a lot of reading today, a lot of quotes. Please raise your hand and let BL know. Okay, we spent the last webinar exploring the formula of revelation, both as prose and as a geometric figure. And during this session, we'll first take a closer look at the number 6, then analyze both the right and left-handed swastikas. Alrighty. Go back into full screen mode here. All right. 6 is the first perfect number, a number equal to the sum of its positive divisors. 6's positive divisors are 1, 2, and 3. Thus, 6 is also the first number to encompass the arithmetic mean. But the further integration of its divisors makes 6 unique among all numbers. For instance, not only does 1 plus 2 plus 3 equal 6, but also 1 times 2 times 3 equals 6. Perfect numbers are very rare. There are only 4 of them between 1 and 10,000. They are 6, 28, 496, and 8,128. The fifth perfect number is 33,550,336. This is going to be a test later, so make sure you get that down. A friend of mine pointed out that all the perfect numbers except 6 numerologically reduce to 1. Okay, more 6 magic. Multiplying powers of 6 always ends in 6. Multiplying powers of 6 always ends in 6, a quality only shared with the number 5 and, of course, the number 1. Ancient civilizations, especially the Greeks, recognized the uniqueness of the number 6. In the Theogony of Arithmetic, Iamblichus described the hexad, which is Greek for the number 6. Let's get a reader for this. Would someone like to volunteer to read this?
Malia, please. Oh.
Okay, thank you. Whereas the triad represents primary perfection, having a middle, a beginning, middle, and end, the hexad has a secondary perfection because it is equal to its own parts, 1 plus 2 plus 3 equals 6. However, the triad's perfection is also found in the hexad through 2 plus 2 plus 2, beginning, middle, and end. The hexad's perfection, equal parts, is not found in the triad.
Thank you. Iamblichus goes on to say, the hexad represents wholeness, permanence, perfect health and intercourse and increase. 6 was also known throughout the ancient world as the perfection of parts, since in being the sum of 1, 2, and 3, 6 contains the principles of the father, mother, and child. Thus, it was considered to be the most fertile of all numbers. Which brings us to the essence of sixness. Whereas 2 reveals the pairs of opposites, and 3 the potential union of those opposites, the archetypal trinity, 6, actually carries that potential into manifestation. Father, mother, and progeny. No surprise, then, that in theosophy, the six-pointed star is known as the star of creation, and the sixth law, the law of love. As in theosophy, which recognizes the six-pointed Solomon's seal as the causal body, The Greeks considered six to be the number of the soul. Iamblichus says, no number is more suited to the soul than the hexad, because it contains the numbers that define the musical third, fifth, and octave. And the soul is functionally harmonic by nature. That is, it mediates between the pairs of opposites. The idea of six as the number of the soul is also found in the sixth sephiroth of the Tree of Life, called Tiferet, which means beauty. Tiferet is the central sephiroth on the middle pillar and represents the descent of the Godhead into consciousness. In the Behir, it states, six is the adorned, glorious, delightful throne of glory, the house of the world to come. Its place is engraved in wisdom, as it says, God said, let there be light, and there was light. Tiferet's function is to harmonize the conflicting forces of the left and right-hand pillars. This is the identical purpose, unity through balance, of the sixth arcanum of the Tarot, the Lovers. Paul Foster Case says, the Lovers' arcanum suggests the union of opposite but complementary modes of existence. He goes on to say that the man depicted in the arcanum is the magician and the woman the high priestess. Thus we have represented the potential for an archetypal completion that begins with the soul and consummates at the sixth initiation, wherein the initiate becomes the divine hermaphrodite. Now, DK tells us that the sixth initiation is the higher correspondence to the second, just as the fifth is the higher correspondence to the first. More specifically, the sixth initiation is to the master as the second is to the disciple. Why? Because by controlling desire, the second initiate is finally able to make decisions based on an awareness beyond the personality, thus coming from a completely new perspective when making choices, a perspective that eventually leads to the sixth initiation, called simply the decision. This is yet another example of the close relationship between, in some cases, the interchangeability of six and two. We see this illustrated simply in the two triangles of the six-pointed star. Counting up takes us into the lofty regions of the monadic plane, the sixth root race, and the sixth planetary scheme, which is the Venusian scheme. Six counting down takes us into the astral realm, workplace of the second initiate, wherein the disciple must transmute his or her emotional nature through the sixth law of love. Of course, the sixth law is not confined to the astral plane, but it is through the work done there that one is able to demonstrate soul alignment. This sixth law of love is illustrated by the sixth arcanum of the Tarot, an arcanum associated with Gemini, which is ruled by the second ray. Interestingly, the positive aspects of the Tarot sixes is also reflected in the four suits of the lower arcana. The Six of Wands is called Victory, the Six of Swords, Science, Six of Cups, Pleasure, and the Six of Pentacles, Success. Each are considered the most auspicious arcanum in their respective suits. This is because they are each the elemental reflections of the sixth sephiroth, Tiferet, which is itself a reflection of Kethor, the Godhead or Ayin Sof. Okay, another key area where six represents the manifest world is in the planes and subplanes, where we find the seed intention carried in the Udi subplane, progressively manifested by means of the six subplanes beneath it. So on the left there, you see the entire cosmic physical plane, and the Udi plane is the top plane there. And then on the right, you see each of the seven Adi planes, the subplanes, the Adi plane of each subplane, and the six beneath it. Okay. This has its geometrical counterpart in the cube slash octahedron dual that we studied during the last session. The six points of the octahedron, which are the six central points of the faces of the cube, represent contact with the form world, with their common central point representing the source or Adi plane. In fact, the six subplanes of the lower three planes are the 666 associated with the beast or animal man. This same concept is illustrated by the 18th arcanum called the moon, 18 being three sixes. Rule 4 from Rays and Initiation states, let the group see all the 18 fires die down, and that the lesser lives return unto the reservoir of life. That reservoir is the Adi plane of each subplane. This is inextricably, This is inextricably connected with the six directions of the cube of space, for lunar reality and the beast are simply metaphors for the manifested world. The Greeks called this aspect of six the primary expression of proportionality, and considered six to be the number of the cosmos. Interesting to note that the word cosmos in Greek geometrically adds to six. Geometry is the study of the value of words, which is also the number of years in the life cycle of the Hindu phoenix. Kartikeya, the rider of this divine bird of wisdom, is often adorned with a six-rayed star, a swastika, and wears a six-pointed crown on his brow, all of which indicate rulership in the realm of time and space. You can see in this illustration, in the small insert, he's even shown with six heads. Okay, Michael Snyder describes six as the exemplar of function, structure, and order, which he believes to be three aspects of the same idea. This triplicity can be found throughout both the organic and inorganic forms in nature. The structure of flies' eyes, insect legs, reptile skin, turtle shells, human lung alveoli, skeletal muscle tissue, carrots, tomatoes, aspirin, vitamin C and D, uranium hexafluoride, which is a nuclear fuel, beehives, quartz crystals, snowflakes, the benzene ring, which is the basic building block of organic chemistry, graphite, steroids, cortisone, testosterone, estrogen, cholesterol, benzene, TNT, the antibiotic, terramycin, not to mention a huge variety of domestic and wildflowers, are just a few examples of the ubiquitous presence of six in the natural world. Much of the success of six in nature comes from the hexagon's ability to tessellate. Like the square and triangle, a series of hexagons is able to cover a flat surface with no gaps. This is called close packing and provides a combination of strength and efficient use of materials unique to the hexagon. The presence of the hexagon in nature has inspired an incredible array of hexagonal art and craftwork down the ages, reaching its height in Islamic art, which combines hexagons with triangles, squares, six-pointed stars, and other figures to achieve patterns of exquisite beauty and subtlety. Keith Critchlow, who some believe to be the dean of the modern sacred geometry movement, has explored this subject in depth in his excellent book entitled Islamic Patterns. Okay, now let's talk a little bit about DK's teachings on the number six. In the Mauryan Federation, which follows the guidelines for esoteric schools set out in Letters on Occult Meditation, the year is divided into 2 6-month segments in accordance with the solstices. These two periods are called the light and dark halves of the year. DK doesn't only recommend these time periods within the context of this future esoteric schools. In most of his instructions to individual disciples, he speaks of working with a meditation or visualization for 6-month periods. For example, DK instructs a disciple to meditate deeply during the next 6 months on the following 6 phrases. There are examples like this throughout both volumes of Discipleship in the New Age. In them, we see the natural connection between 6 and 2, expressed as a waxing and waning, light half of the year, dark half of the year, which can be illustrated by the sine wave. In one instruction, DK says, inhale as you count 6, and imagine, as you do, that you are gathering up the forces of the solar plexus center to the head. Then exhale for 6 counts, and as you do, realize that these forces are pouring out through the center between the eyebrows, the 6th center, onto the world of men. Various times DK gives 6 statements, 6 phrases, 6 questions, 6 brief commands, 6 vibrations, 6 seed thoughts, and 6 steps in meditation. Many of these to be considered over a period of 6 months. In this context, DK uses the number 6 far more than any other number. We can hypothesize from this that 6 is a natural cycle with a beginning, middle, and an end, and that 2 such cycles make up the greater cycle of 12. In this regard, it's interesting to note that 60-second, 60-minute, and even 24-hour cycles numerologically reduce to 6. Okay, now let's take a quick look at the 6th ray. DK tells us that through the work of Neptune in Cancer and Mars in Scorpio, Ray 6 transforms, quote, mass consciousness into the inclusive consciousness of the disciple. A significant amount of this work is done on the 6th or astral plane through transformation of the energy of the solar plexus. Mars, a non-sacred 6th ray planet, rules the solar plexus of the average human being. Neptune, a sacred 6th ray planet, rules the solar plexus of the disciple. Remember the idea put forward during the last session that the 6-pointed octahedron represents the indwelling Jiva? Well, through the trials brought on by Ray 6, especially in Scorpio, we could say that the energy of the octahedron begins to dominate the cube, or form nature, and the triumphant disciple begins to emerge. But until this emergence, Ray 6 is somewhat of a nightmare. It produces, quote, fanaticism, unreasoning devotion, and blind acceptance of conditions. We see this playing out in the personality rays of both the USA and Russia, which are caught in the Ray 6 shadow. Note the color similarities. This is further emphasized by the fact that, one, the energy of Ray 6 dominates the Piscean Age from which we are emerging, and two, Ray 6 has a natural affinity with the astral plane in which most human beings are polarized. Fortunately, on soul levels, the enlightened use of the 6th ray becomes a means of clearing the astral plane. We see this in the soul ray of Spain, whose keywords are, I disperse the clouds. The sense associated with the 6th ray is taste, which manifests on the astral plane as imagination, the mental plane is discrimination, and the Buddhic plane as intuition. The color associated with the 6th ray is rose, unique among the ray colors. Rose represents a particular stage of development, as is described in this old commentary. Could we get a reader, please, for this passage?
Please go ahead, Anne. Are you there, Anne? Okay, let's try Clesia. Can you please go ahead, Clesia?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. The life that only knows itself as form enshrouds itself in vivid red. The red knows, red of known desire, and through the red, all longed for forms approach, are grasped and held, used and discarded, until the red changes to rose and rose to the palest pink, and pink to white. Forth flowers then pure white rose of life.
Thank you, Felicia. Rose appears in every petal of the egoic lotus, except for two of the knowledge petals, which tells us that the energy of the sixth ray is critical towards our passage to the soul. Possibly this is because there is, quote, a direct correspondence between the rose of the astral and the yellow of the Buddhic plane. Finally, on the number six, the three great avatars mentioned by Dwalko, Heracles, the Buddha, and the Christ, all had the first, second, and sixth rays in their makeup. Heracles had a sixth-ray astral body, the Buddha a sixth-ray mind, and which was a very rare phenomenon, and the Christ had a sixth-ray personality. DK says, these three all embodied the essences of the spiritual life. And this is an important statement. And all of them were enabled to set their seal upon history and upon the hearts of men, largely through the potency of their sixth ray expression. Okay. Because the law of love and the number six are so deeply connected, let's explore this law in a bit greater detail. I'd like to use three readers for this extended passage. Let's assign the readers now, and then when the text changes, just move on to the next reader.
Okay. Anne says she's worked out her mic issues, so we'll do Anne, Leia, and Mona.
Hello.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Hi. Are you Anne?
Yes, I'm Anne.
Okay. Hold on just a second before you start. I just want to make a comment. When DK, during this extended passage, when DK refers to the concrete rays, he's speaking of the odd-numbered rays. When he refers to the abstract rays, he's speaking of the even-numbered. This is in keeping with the idea that the concrete rays are expressive of the occult and the abstract rays of the mystical. So go ahead, Anne. Thank you.
Okay. The law of love is in reality but the law of the system in demonstration on all the planes. Love was the impelling motive for manifestation, and love it is that keeps all in order sequence. Love bears all on the path of return to the Father's bosom, and love eventually perfects all that is. It is love that builds the form that cradles temporally the inner hidden life, and love is the cause of the disruption of those forms and their utter shattering so that the life may further progress.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Leia, please go ahead.
Love manifests on each plane as the urge that drives the evolving monad onwards to its goal. And love is the key to the Deva kingdom and the reason of the blending of the two kingdoms eventually into the divine hermaphrodite. Love works through the concrete rays in the building of the system and in the rearing of the structure that shelters the spirit. And love works through the abstract rays for the full and potent development of that inherent divinity.
Okay. Third reader, please.
Lona, please go ahead.
Okay. Love demonstrates to the concrete rays the aspect of divinity, forms the persona that hides the oneself. Love demonstrates through the abstract rays in developing the attributes of divinity, and evolving to fullest measure the kingdom of God within. Love in the concrete rays leads to the path of occultism. Love in the abstract rays leads to that of the mystic. Love forms, shelters, and inspires the life. Love causes the logoic vibration to surge forward, carrying all on its way, and bringing all to perfected manifestation.
Thank you all. Appreciate it. DK goes on to say, the sixth ray of devotion and the sixth law of love have a close alliance. And on the sixth plane comes the powerful working out in the lower triad, the personality, of the law of love. The astral plane is, at the present time, the most important for us, for in desire, not corrected or transmuted, lies the difference between the personal consciousness and that of the ego. The theme of love and its relation to the number six is present not only in the planes and rays, but also in the subraces, races, globes, rounds, chains, and schemes, as we see in the following quote. Can we get a reader for this section, please?
Please.
I know
ahead.
This is a lot of reading, but it's this really is the core teaching on the law of love.
Please go ahead, Suzanne. We can't hear you, Suzanne. Are you?
Can you hear me?
Just barely. Can you speak louder?
Yes. Is this better?
A
That's
little.
Better. If you could get closer to your mic, that would help.
Okay. In the sixth chain of each scheme, the sixth law and the sixth ray have a very important significance. Whilst the seventh chain of each scheme is always synthetic, love and activity in a perfect balance. The same effect can be demonstrated in the sixth round. In the sixth round of the present chain of the Earth scheme, the sixth law will demonstrate with great clarity and force, as love shown in brotherhood, love translated or transmuted from the astral to the Buddhic. So in the sixth root race and the sixth sub-race, a similar analogy will be seen. Out of the shattered form of the fifth sub-race of the fifth root race, built up under the fifth ray of concrete knowledge, with the aid of the fifth law of fixation, will emerge the sixth sub-race of brotherly love, love shown in the realization of the one life latent in each son of God.
Thank you, Suzanne. So we see the deep connection between two and six, the second ray of love wisdom and the sixth law of love. Graphically, we see this in the six-pointed star with its two opposing overlapping triangles, creating a new six-sided unity in the central hexagon. This could be a metaphor for union of opposite sexes, union with one soul, union between the Deva and the human kingdoms, or even the union of two planetary logi. DK says, the sixth scheme, that of Venus, is the scheme of love. Viewed from one angle, the Venusian scheme is the second, and from another, it is the sixth. It depends upon whether we reason from the circumference to the center or the reverse. We could probably spend the rest of the webinar just exploring why that might be true. Unfortunately, we don't have the time to do that. That which connects the point to the circumference is the radius. Since six is, as HPV points out, the animating or informing principle, we could hypothesize that love is able to demonstrate in the manifested universe as a result of the fact that the side of a hexagon is equal to the radius of its enclosing circle. That is to say, love manifests through the energetic transference from the primordial radius to the phohatically charged hexagon. The radius was the first extension from the all-encompassing unity, and thus could be seen as representing the first act of love. Stanza 3, verse 3 from the Secret Doctrine tells us, darkness radiates light. and light drops one solitary ray into the waters, into the Mother Deep. That one solitary ray, the radius, emanated from the central point of unity and defined the circumference of the manifested world. It's interesting to note that six radii, equal to the six sides of a hexagon, form three diameters, one for each of the trinity of Father, Mother, and Son, in which the number six is said to contain. Okay, let's move into our analysis of the swastika, starting with the physical. DK describes this first step simply as its exoteric consideration, line, form, and color. So at this point, we're not looking for meaning or significance, but rather for a tabulation of physical attributes. It'd be great if you participate when called on, briefly describe a single physical attribute. Your observations may seem obvious, like the ones listed here. That's fine. Any ideas that help us to physically define this figure are useful. Okay, I'll start. By the way, as others and I describe these attributes, consider preparing for the next step of our analysis by imagining their possible meanings and significances. You may even want to jot down the ideas that occur to you in order to share during the next segment. Okay, the swastika, which can be oriented with its outer arms extended either to the left or right, is made up of two three-line segments set at right angles to each other. These lines can also be seen as eight equal length line segments. Okay, any further observations? What other physical characteristics do you see? Anybody have any ideas? DL, do we have any takers?
Yes, please go ahead, Yvonne.
One's going clockwise and one's going counterclockwise.
Right. Yes, it's interesting. And the debate over which is which is varies from one school of thought to the next. Thank you. Anyone else? Any other thoughts about the physical attributes of either or both swastikas?
All of the angles are at 90 degrees.
Correct. This is, there's only one angle in the swastika, and it's a 90 degree angle. Other ideas? Other observations about the physical attributes of the swastika?
Please go ahead, Martin.
Yes, there are three vertical and three horizontal lines.
Actually, there's
more if you divide them, but
Right. That's interesting. Yeah, it's right. So if you don't divide the middle line, the middle vertical or the middle horizontal, then it's three. Thank you. Yeah.
Okay.
Good to have you here, Martin. Other thoughts?
Please go ahead, Suzanne.
The symmetry is noticeable.
Yes, they're almost precisely symmetrical, aren't they? They are precisely symmetrical, each to itself, within itself. Yeah. Any other thoughts? Any other observations?
Anne says four squares.
Four open squares. Right. Yeah. For suggested squares. Other thoughts?
Please go ahead, Mr. Murthy.
Yeah, this left one is positive, the right one is negative. The conventional usage is the left swastika we use in India.
Right. It's great to have you here, because in Hinduism, that's right. It's associated with Kali. At this point, I would like to restrict our observations just to physical attributes. In our next segment, We'll look at the meaning and significance. And your okay. your comment would pertain to that. Thank you.
Okay.
So other just physical observations.
Would there be not just four open squares, but there are five, the large one?
Yes, that's true. The one that encompasses the smaller four. Is that what you're thinking?
Yeah.
That's true. Yeah. So there's really five squares. Other thoughts? That's good.
Nancy, did you have a comment?
Yes. This is a little bit odd, but both of them individually indicate dynamic movement or action, it seems to me, but together, facing each other, they seem to cancel each other out.
Or balance each other, depending on how you like it. Yeah. That's, in fact, that's one of those borderline things that has a little more to do with the meaning. But yes, because it is also intrinsic, just in the physicality of it. But it's a kind of implied meaning, you know. But yeah, it's your observation is noted. Thank you. Anything else? Purely physical attributes.
It's
hard to stay out of meaning, isn't it? Because it seems so pregnant with meaning. Go ahead.
Anne adds that if you put one on top of the other, then you have four closed squares.
Mm-hmm. That's quite correct. And a fifth that surrounds it. Thank you.
And then Helen says triangles can be formed by connecting the tip of each arm diagonally to its opposite arm.
Brilliant. That's right. I actually have some graphics to support your observations. So thank you for that. Other thoughts?
Scott, please go ahead. You're on self-mute. We can't hear you. You're on self-mute.
He's probably struggling with it.
Scott, we still can't hear you. You're on self-mute.
Let's come back.
Okay.
Any other thoughts?
There you go.
I found him. The new symbols there kind of threw me off. They moved, it seems. Anyway, looking at the figure, it seems to be two-dimensional, but that's just what we want to see. It actually can be three-dimensional.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The bent lines give you more dimensions, and it's part of the movement, higher understanding of the symbol.
Yep. That's absolutely right. Yeah, thanks for that. And actually, we'll get into that a little more when we get to the meaning. But it is also intrinsic in the shapes of these the swastikas, that sense of three-dimensionality. Anyone else? Okay, I'm going to move on. And here's some additional physical attributes. Some of these you've brought forward. I present them again in order to share my illustrations with you. Since it has no enclosed spaces, the swastika can be called an open figure. However, if we overlay two swastikas, as someone pointed out, we get a closed figure with four small squares enclosed by a fifth square. Either swastika creates four U shapes whose openings face the four directions. At the center of both swastikas is the same equal-armed cross. Both swastikas have, Martin pointed out, three lines. If you look at them as segments, then it's four vertical and four horizontal lines. Joining the endpoints of the extended lines of either swastika creates an equal-arm X. This, in turn, creates four right-angled isosceles triangles, which was also pointed out, and that was a really good observation. The swastika has eight 90-degree angles, adding to 720 degrees, the number of degrees in two circles. The swastika marks the cardinal directions, as well as the four intermediate directions. The geometry of the swastika allows one to easily determine the golden ratio. First, divide one of the swastika's line segments in half by drawing a diagonal line, as illustrated in that upper left diagram. Then rotate half this diagonal line until it intersects the baseline. The point of intersection marks the golden ratio. That is to say, this new extended baseline is in a golden ratio proportion to any of the eight swastika line segments. Okay, DK separates the next stage of our analysis into two parts as follows. Could we get a reader for these two steps?
Martha, would you please read for us? We don't hear her. Okay. Let's try. Please go ahead, Iris.
A comprehension in the astral or emotional body of its quality, the reaction of a sensitive response to the impact of its qualitative nature. A conceptual consideration of its underlying idea, of what it is intended to teach, of the intellectual meaning it is intended to convey.
Thank you. Okay, in the interest of time, we'll consider these two steps at the same time. When sharing, you're welcome to speak to either the emotional or conceptual aspects of the right and or left-handed swastika. So, considering the list of physical attributes as well as those you have brought forth, what quality, significance, and or meaning can we ascribe to either or both swastikas? Here's one example each based on quality or significance and on conceptual meaning. In terms of significance, I think we would all agree that there is no symbol that has a greater stigma attached to it than the swastika. It just is just as a result of us being at this particular time and point in history. Stigma created through its ubiquitous use by the Nazi Party in World War II Germany. DK says, actually, let's get a reader for this, if we could.
Malia, please go ahead.
It is in the lower aspect of this cross that the Nazis chose this symbol as theirs. They were expressing, at the close of the material cycle of human existence, the false and evil use of matter, of which separativeness, cruelty, and selfishness is the key. The misuse of substance and the prostitution of matter and form to evil ends is the sin against the Holy Spirit. It might be said that the swastika drives into danger dire and into evil ways those whose greed is great and who see no beauty in the dawning light and who know no love of human lives.
You know, it's interesting to note that, one of the last dates of the war was 1944, and that in the swastika we have those four squares. So we literally have the date. And I've thought of this just now as a result of seeing what he says here, that we're coming to this, the deepest point of materiality. Where is it? It's this, the close of the material cycle. Before it was adopted as a symbol of the Nazi Party in 1921, the swastika was a popular symbol throughout the world, a lot like the peace symbol was in the 60s. This, you might think this is a German group during the war, but it's not. It was the jerseys of the Canadian girls' hockey team, and you find it all over. There was no stigma at all attached to it until 1921. and its stigma has been prolonged through its use by neo-Nazis worldwide. Ironically, the word swastika, which comes from Sanskrit, means a state of auspiciousness. Okay, in terms of conceptual meaning, the swastika suggests rotational motion. This was brought up by a number of you. In fact, the primary difference between the two swastikas is the direction of the motion suggested. But the perspective on the direction of motion of each swastika varies from tradition to tradition. Do the extended arms lead, as pictured on the left, or follow, as pictured on the right? You know, people see this differently. Besides clockwise and counterclockwise, the swastika suggests multi-dimensional motion, as in a wheel turning on itself. In fact, it's quite possible that Ezekiel's vision was of the swastika in motion. Okay, that's my two cents. Any further ideas on the quality, significance, and or meaning of either or both swastikas? As you're thinking about this, you may wish to consider our list of physical attributes. I'll give you a minute to review. Just raise your hand when you're ready.
Okay, Malia has typed in a little thing that says the Nazis rotated the symbol 45 degrees, and then a question mark, a perversion.
Well, you know, any symbol in its pure form, out of context for how it's used, is not, I'll go out on a limb to say, it's not inherently a perversion. But and frankly, I can't give you a reason why standing it on its edge, on its end, or on its point, I should say, would further the materialistic purpose. In some ways, it's a good thing because it, in some small way, distinguished it from the swastikas that are used by, you know, Hindus and Buddhists and the Jains and by others all over the world, which always set it square and always have. So it's not an entirely satisfactory answer, but that's my insight on that. Okay. Anybody have any thoughts on this?
Please go ahead, Martin.
Yes, the wheel turning on itself and the going in two directions has a lot of implications, but implicit in it is freedom of choice and the whole message of Libra and many other things, but and the law of Sirius and a few other things, but that's a good start.
That's interesting, yeah. Taken together, the swastikas really are a symbol of balance, as in Libra. In fact, I had a Chinese robe at one time, and it had a symbol on it, which I actually haven't been able to find anywhere, which is the two swastikas, and in the center, a circle with a diameter, the diameter line. And it, that circle was set right between the two, which suggested the balance of the two, almost like a yin-yang quality of the two swastikas. So yeah, I think balance is an important part. Of course, neither swastika by itself carries that meaning.
Only together.
Right? Yeah, only together. It's as I see it, yeah. And then your other point, which is the idea of freedom of movement, that's very interesting. In one way, you could see that the two swastikas don't necessarily, as Scott mentioned when we were talking about the physical attributes, that it's not just moving in opposite directions. It could be that the two swastikas together describe the whole idea of a wheel turning on itself, that's the concept, that's the esoteric interpretation of the two swastikas. Any other thoughts as to the meaning or significance?
Yes, we have several comments. Julie says open doorway, incarnation, and then back.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yvonne, please go ahead.
The last comment that was made about energy, what reminded me of these going different directions is the chakras, the energy centers. Mm-hmm. Supposedly when a chakra is open, it's spinning clockwise. And then when it's closed or something's wrong, it's spinning counterclockwise. I was wondering if that's analogous at all.
Well, actually, DK, and I'll be reading this, has a segment that directly connects the swastika to the centers when they're in full motion. As to the directions, I can't verify your findings. The evolutional direction is considered to be counterclockwise. The involutional direction is considered to be clockwise. But even that is somewhat tricky, because if you look down on something spinning clockwise and you pick that thing up, like say a fan, and you pick that thing up and you hold it over your head, it's spinning in the same direction as it was before, but now it's moving counterclockwise in reference to your perspective. So in some ways the whole idea of clockwise and counterclockwise is one of perspective. Any other thoughts?
Suzanne says center point of each is a place of stillness.
Mm-hmm. That's an important point. Yeah, the central point itself is not in motion. In fact, that's, you have this duality between stillness and motion. It's an important part of the concept. Good. Not any other thoughts?
Yes, Malia, please go ahead.
It has been said that Hitler, as somewhat of an occultist himself, was aware that by rotating the swastika, that it depresses the energy field of people and makes them easier to manipulate because they don't have the same free will.
That's interesting. It begs the question how that occurs as a result of turning at 45 degree angles. It's a fascinating thought, and there is a lot of evidence supporting the idea that the Gang of Seven, as they're sometimes called, who incarnated in Germany at that time, were occultists and used these symbols and methods in a very specific black magical way.
Yeah.
Thank you for that. Other thoughts?
Let me see. Anne says, I have read about a rod on fire going round and it makes a swastika.
Interesting. Okay. Other thoughts? Anyone else?
Yvonne, you have another comment?
About the chakras and the direction, when I was in healing school, they said if you put your thumb, close your fist, put your thumb into your chakra, like your heart chakra or solar plexus, the direction your fingers are going, the direction your fingers are rotating or going, is the direction, the right-hand rule. That's the direction the chakra is rotating, which is right.
Interesting.
Okay,
so that's a way of nailing that down.
It's from Barbara Brennan, School of Healing.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Other thoughts? Anyone else have any ideas about the meaning of the swastika? Isn't it Mercury? Is that right? It's that's your last name, though. I don't know your first name. You were talking about the positive and negative aspects of the swastika, which I know is a Hindu belief. Are you there? Would you like to talk a little more about that? Can you call on him, Bill?
Yeah, go ahead, please. I've unmuted you. You may be on self-mute. We can't hear you yet.
Is it related to Tree of Life or Flower of Life?
I'm sorry?
Can you hear me? Sir?
I'm sorry. You know, for me, you're breaking up a lot. You're moving in and out. So could you try again?
Is swastika is related to Power of Life or Tree of Life? Any significance?
Well, it certainly is connected to the Tree of Life, yeah. The lines or the channels that connect the various Sephiroth in the Tree of Life, those are energetically connected through the potency of the swastika. You could say that the swastika is intimately connected with Fohat, which we'll discover as we get into the secret doctrine, which we're about to do here in a little bit. That it is a method of energy transfer. It's a means, for instance, for the unseen realms to manifest and for us to return. It's very Fohatic in the sense that it bridges the planes and subplanes. It's often represented interestingly, by a bird. You know, Shiva has Garuda, which is this bird that enables him to actually move down into the lower planes. Yeah, I'm sure you know much more about this than I do. But specifically to the swastika, it's an energetic mode of movement. So, well then, shall we move on? Does
We do have a couple of more comments here.
Good.
Julie says magnetism and electricity of the dual energies.
Mm-hmm. Magnetism and electricity, yeah. Well, right. It's very much associated with, especially electricity, in its higher sense of the term. They are, you could say, the means by which the Fohatic electrical impulse is able to penetrate into matter. Okay, other thoughts?
And Clesia says, symbol of transmission. That happens when mm-hmm. in a state of balance, and thus brings in higher energy, redeeming the lower vibration.
Ooh, I like that. Yeah, yeah. You're really calling this higher energy down and by means of the swastika motion. Thank you.
Okay, that's it.
Okay, folks, if that's all, I will move on. Okay. As usual, while preparing for this webinar, I developed a list of significances and meanings related to our figure. But after researching the history of and the esoteric writings on the swastika, especially in the secret doctrine, in the interest of time, I have opted to present this research instead, mainly because the ideas I had come up with were represented in the teachings that I researched, but to a much more profound degree. So I'm just going to move it this way. The swastika is among the most esoteric of all the symbols we have looked at during this series of webinars. The earliest known swastika is from Mazin, Ukraine. It was carved on a late Paleolithic figurine of mammoth ivory, the extinct mammoth, around 10,000 BC. But according to HPB, quote, the swastika is certainly one of the oldest symbols of the ancient races, thus extending its use back into the dawn of time. Early swastikas have been found in Persia, Lebanon, England, Norway, Denmark, the Indus Valley, Africa, Vietnam, Native America, ancient Rome, Neolithic China, Samarra, Armenia, Galicia, in other words, pretty much everywhere you can find that it was used. Exoterically, swastik means state of auspiciousness. Swastika means the bestowing of that state. Thus, to the vast majority of lay Hindu and Buddhists, it is a symbol of blessing and good luck. Esoterically, the Sanskrit sva means the higher self. Asti means being. Thus, swastika means being in the higher self. In Hinduism, the swastika represents the four purusharthas. And you'll have to pardon my pronunciation, Murthy. I know I'm slaughtering it. Which are dharma, that which is makes a human. Artha, which is often called fortune, but you could call it the material aspect. Karma, desire. And moksha, or liberation. Hindus recognize and mark 16 transitions during the life of every human being. In each of these, the swastika plays an important role, for its shape and implied motion is seen as a magical means of transitioning from one phase of life to the next. For example, in Hindu weddings, the bride and groom kneel before an image of the swastika as the marriage ceremony begins. And during a ceremony called Upanayana, which marks the acceptance of a student by his guru, the swastika is painted on top of the shaven head of the acolyte. The five-day Hindu festival of Diwali, which heralds the new year, is also called the Festival of Light, for it marks the triumph of good and evil. During the ceremony, swastikas are painted on the first page of all the account books for the new year, thus attracting the blessings of Lakshmi, goddess of fortune. Now, Lakshmi is the wife of Vishnu, and one of the 108 sacred symbols that identify Vishnu is the right-handed swastika, which resides on the forefinger, representing the manifested universe. The arms of the swastika, called Kal, is, as in calendar, represent time. So by extending his forefinger, Vishnu brings into being time and thus temporal existence by means of the swastika. The swastika is also the symbol of Surya, the Hindu sun god, its four arms representing the sun's movement through the sky, another reference to time. In Hinduism, the left-handed swastika is associated with night and thus with Kali. However, for the most part, it's not seen as evil. After all, Kali worship was practiced by saints such as Ramakrishna. Now, this same left-handed swastika is the more commonly used swastika in Buddhism. And on regional maps, marks the location of Buddhist stupas. Look closely and you'll see a whole bunch of swastikas describing these stupas. In Buddhist philosophy, the swastika is said to contain the whole mind of Buddha. I mean, think about that. The swastika contains the mind of Buddha and can often be found imprinted on the chest, feet, or palms of Buddha images. The swastika is considered the most auspicious of the 65 auspicious symbols associated with the footprint of Buddha. So auspicious, in fact, that it is used to mark the beginning of Buddhist texts. It is also called the seal on the Buddha's heart. So heart, mind, and feet. Quite an important symbol in Buddhism. In Jainism, the four arms of the swastika represent the four possible destinies in the cycle of birth and death. Heavenly beings, human beings, animal and plant beings, and hellish beings. But we must turn to the secret doctrine for a truly esoteric understanding of the swastika. Notice it there at the top of the symbol. Let's choose two readers now. And we'll just move to the second reader when you see the text change. Okay, could we pick a couple of readers, please?
Yes, we're going to start with Scott and then go to Trudy.
Okay, great.
Okay, I can be heard?
Yes.
You can.
Great. Few world symbols are more pregnant with real occult meaning than the swastika. It's symbolized by the figure 6. For, like that figure, it points in its concrete imagery, as the ideograph of the number does, to the zenith and the nadir, to north, south, west, and east. One finds the unit everywhere, and that unit reflected in all and every unit. It is the emblem of the activity of Fohat, of the continual revolution of the wheels, and of the four elements, the sacred four. Further, his four arms, bent at right angles, are intimately related to the Pythagorean and Hermetic scales. One initiated into the mysteries of the meaning of the swastika, says the commentaries, can trace on it with mathematical precision the evolution of cosmos and the whole period of Sadhana. Also, the relation of the seen to the unseen and the first procreation of man and species.
Thanks, Scott. By the way, Sanya is translated as dusk or a transitional period. Okay, so let's move on to this.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
There we go. Please go ahead, Trudy.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Remember the allegory of Vishwakarma, the creative power, the great architect of the world, called in the Veda the all-seeing God, who sacrifices himself to himself. The spiritual ego of mortals are his own essence, one with him, therefore. Remember that he is called Deva Vadhika, the builder of the gods, and that it is he who ties the sun, Surya, his son-in-law, on his lace in the exoteric allegory, on the swastika in esoteric tradition, as on earth he is the Hierophant initiator and puts away a portion of his brightness.
Thank you. So in the first quote, we discover that the swastika is a means by which Fohat becomes active. Fohat, through a progressive revolution of wheels, drives spirit into the realm of space and time. In the second quote, we have an allegory of this teaching, wherein the builder of the gods, the third logos, ties the formless solar deity to the swastika, and by driving him down into the world of form, quote, cuts away a portion of his brightness. Because, you know, when the formless realms enter the realm of form, the brightness is reduced. This is, of course, a sacrificial act made for the redemption of the form world, that part of the form world lying within Surya's ring pasnat. So, it looks like, you know, actually doing fairly well with the time. Does anybody have any questions or comments about either of these paragraphs? I wanted to point out that, you know, Blavatsky is a unique writer. And she says that it is symbolized by this figure 6, which I thought was fascinating. For like that figure, it you know, it points in all the directions, which was, you know, one of the reasons I it sort of verified that that I would like to conclude this series on the four webinars on the number 6 with the swastika. But what about that concept of one finds the unit everywhere, and that unit reflected in all and every unit. Any thoughts about any of these concepts in either paragraph here?
Scott, please go ahead.
Yeah, I was thinking back on the previous paragraph, talking about the twilight, and remembering that this refers to Venus, the star of the morning and the evening light. The connection you've already made with six, and the fact that, the esoteric fact that Venus receives three times the light that the Earth does and passes on one third. This is a description of this cutting away a portion of its brightness. As Surya does in some legends of being shorn of his brightness.
Yes. Yeah.
Passing of the soul down and yet still being whole, but yet passing along a third of its light in case of Venus to the Earth, being our elder brother.
And fantastic.
Soul.
Yeah, so we move into, you know, from the a more cosmic consideration of this teaching into our systemic through Venus. Yeah, I like that that whole idea. It's Venus as the six being active in this process. You know, any other thoughts about this, folks, before we move on?
Helen says, these units are found everywhere, the golden rule, the building diva.
Okay, yeah. I think one of the things that they're saying here is the ubiquitous quality of the swastika. You're going to find it in an atom of substance. You're going to find it also in the entire universe. It's almost like a mathematical function in that it's a means of moving energy. And so it's going to be inherent as well as transcendent, or so you have it immanent and transcendent. Other thoughts?
Martin, please go ahead.
Yeah, just what you said earlier about Adi, and then the six subplanes on each of the planes is the same concept. It's everywhere. Adi is on the logoic plane and also on the densest plane and every plane in between. It's like the center of the circle, and it's everywhere.
Yeah, and in fact, the whole idea of the Adi or Adi subplane being separated out on top of the other six is a kind of heresy, because it's, you know, but how do you illustrate it? You know, it's inherent in all. So thanks for that. Okay. Any more thoughts before we move on?
Scott, you have something else to say?
Yeah. Thinking about the way the swastika, which is which, remembering that DK gives this the swastika as the cross of the mutable cross, and he has it as the Nazi cross, which I see it as the flags are kind of flying in the wind. So it's actually turning, as I see it, the Nazi is turning counterclockwise. And yet, as we saw, the Theosophical swastika rotated the opposite direction, the one at the top of their glyph. So that's the way I look at it. Is one, there's involution, evolutionary. See, the swastika there is a clockwise turn to me, the way I look at it.
Right.
Also, remembering too, thinking too of the swastika dealing with three dimensions or the wheels turning upon themselves. That if you just take the cross by itself and separate it from the circle, then you have the purely phallic and material representation of the arm cross.
Right.
That when you put the flags back on it, the arms, they are parts of a circle of it spinning. You're showing only part of that. And if you turn those arms in different directions, you'll get the three-dimensional spheres or wheels again turning. So it's three dimensions and yet suggests a fourth. But it's three flywaves of wheels or spheres turning, and the circle and the sphere being so important to seeing it as a spiritual symbol and not just as a equal iron cross without motion or a spiritual element.
Right. If there's any single attribute that you have to emphasize, it's the fact that this symbol is in motion, which, you know, hasn't been so true with most of the symbols we've studied. Even though everything is in motion, this really epitomizes motion. I mean, look where it's placed here, you know, with the Ouroboros. It's where the tail and head meet, you know, the Alpha Omega. And that's, as is always the case in this type of symbology, not by accident. Go ahead.
I say that's also this, again, back to the twilight time, this transition time from head to tail.
That's right.
Of these, and the hip seasons, the solstices, where is this transition of light, and that's sort of here too, and a symbol of time as well.
Yeah. Thanks for those comments. Does anyone else have any thoughts on this important teaching here?
I have one more comment from Julie. It could represent etheric energy and also Kundalini energy, or Ida and Pingala energy of the etheric spine.
Definitely. It does, in fact, represent that. And we'll be reading a passage from DK that describes the swastika in relation to the revolving centers that that verifies what you're saying there. So thank you for that. Okay. So let's get back up here to... Here we go. Can we get another reader for this third passage?
Yvonne, can you read this, please?
Since Fohat crossed the circle like two lines of flame, horizontally and vertically, the hosts of the Blessed Ones have never failed to send their representatives upon the planets they are made to watch over from the beginning. This is why the swastika is always placed, as the ansated cross was in Egypt, on the breasts of the defunct mystics. It is found on the heart of the images and the statues of Buddha in Tibet and Mongolia. It is the seal placed also on the hearts of the living initiates, burned into the flesh forever with some. This because they have to keep those truths inviolate and intact in eternal silence and secrecy to the day these are perceived and read by their chosen successors, new initiates worthy of being entrusted with the 10,000 perfections.
Thank you. Quite a paragraph in that. So each succeeding perfection of these 10,000 perfections moves the initiate closer to the one life. Perhaps this is why in one of the earlier catacombs inscribed next to a carved swastika are the words Vitalis Vitalia, or life of life. I looked everywhere for a picture of this. This is information from the Secret Doctrine. Unfortunately, I couldn't find a photo of this, so it associates the swastika with this concept of the life of life. The source of the one life emanates from the swastika's central point, which is pointed out by someone, which is one with the central point of the circle that encloses it. That's why Scott was talking about the idea of with or without the circle is whether it becomes a sacred or phallic or profane image, that is to say, a materialistic image. And one of the reasons is because the circle allows the central point of the swastika to be identified with that higher central point of the circle. HPB says, Actually, let's, here's the central point, the mutual central point. So, can we get someone to read this short passage?
Nancy, will you read that for us, please?
Did you ask me, Nancy?
Yes, please.
I didn't hear. Oh, okay, sorry. The swastika's central point is not limited to one individual, no matter how perfect, for the God principle is in humanity, and humanity, as all the rest of creation, is in it, like drops of water are in the ocean, the four ends being toward the four cardinal points, hence losing themselves in infinity.
Thank you. So, you know, this takes us all the way back to the idea that you find the unit everywhere, and that unit reflected in all and every unit. It's the same concept here. Okay. So up till this point, we've been mainly considering the effect of the involutionary swastika. We'll go to Decay's teachings on the role of the swastika in the life of the occultist to get some idea of the effect of the evolutionary swastika. We'll begin with a quote describing the effect of its lower influence. Can we get a reader, please?
Please go ahead, Iris.
To those who respond not to the lower aspects and effects of the whirling cross, the swastika flings them from itself and far afield until they come to rest upon the cross of chosen crucifixion, the fixed cross of the pledged disciple.
Thank you. So in this context, he's relating the swastika to the mutable cross, right? Later, he describes the culminating cosmic effect of the evolutionary swastika. Can we get a reader for this section?
Ecclesia, please go ahead, but you're on self-mute, so. There you go, thank you.
The swastika, or the fire, extending not only from the periphery to the center in the four directions, but gradually circulating and radiating from and around the entire periphery. This signifies a completed activity in every department of matter until finally we have a blazing, fiery wheel turning every way with radiant channels of fire from the center to the ring pass knot. Fire within, without, and around until the wheel is consumed and there is naught remaining but perfected fire.
Thank you. Okay, finally, DK gives us a similar teaching, but specifically descriptive of the chakras of the initiate in their final phase. The chakras, that is. It's descriptive of the chakras themselves. Can we get a reader for this section?
Hello?
Anne, please go
Hi.
Ahead.
The swastika. At this stage, the center becomes fourth dimensional. The inner rotating cross begins to turn upon its axis and to drive the flaming periphery to all sides so that the center is better described as a sphere of fire than as a wheel. It marks the stage of the path in its two divisions, for the process of producing the effect described covers the whole period of the path. At the close, the centers are seen as globes of radiant fire with the spokes of the wheel, or the evolution of the cross from the point in the center, merging and blending in a fire that burneth up to the whole.
Thank you. You know, what Scott said was right. It becomes fourth dimensional, as well as because of its furious pace of rotation, becomes as a sphere, a fiery sphere. And remember that these centers are not just centers of human beings. They're also cosmic centers. You know, every planet of the seven sacred planets are centers in the body of the solar logos. So we have the same phenomena that will occur in the later stages of the solar system. Okay, does anybody have any thoughts or comments on those, either of those paragraphs, before we move on?
No, Anne wanted to add the same thing you just did about in the cosmic fire, you know, it's the symbol of that. But then you said that, so you covered
okay.
it. And I don't see any
okay.
other hands or...
Well, as I'm looking at the time, I think we need to move it anyway. So now let's take a look at the next stage in DK's analysis, which is the stage of the synthetic grasp of the purpose of a symbol, of its place in an ordered manifesting plan, of its true unified intent. The stage is not about attributes. Rather, it has to do with synthesis and unity, synthetic purpose and unified intent. So just as the first stage has to do with the physical plane, the second with the astral, the third with the mental, the lower mental, this stage suggests we apply our intuition and thus lift our consciousness to even higher levels. Notice, too, that in this stage, it's divided into three aspects. The stage of the synthetic grasp of the purpose of a symbol, of its place in an ordered manifesting plan, and of its true unified intent. So, what is this synthetic purpose or unified intent of the swastika, and what is its place in an ordered manifesting plan? Another way of saying it is, what single purpose characterizes the swastika? Okay, if any of us were truly able to answer this question, we would probably be in the higher ranks of the hierarchy. But, you know, we're angels fear to tread, right? So let's take a stab at this. Any ideas about the synthetic purpose of the swastika?
Martin?
Take a moment to consider. Oh, okay, great. Go for it.
Okay, it's the will of God to manifest. And I could say more, but I think that says it all.
It's the will of God manifesting.
To manifest.
Yeah, to manifest. And I would say that the swastika, being an active principle, is the actual process of movement into manifestation. Thanks for that.
Well, just one further comment. Just
yeah.
if you talk about Aries and Libra, and mm-hmm. Aries being related to will, and Libra to the center of balance that makes manifestation possible, that's a whole discussion in and of itself, because Aries turns the wheel both clockwise and counterclockwise, and Libra is the centering point for both turning. So that's worth pondering.
Yes, it is. Interesting. Other ideas?
Yes.
As to this...
Sorry.
Okay, go ahead.
Yogi says, ever the path to tread and be.
Mm-hmm. Yes. It's very related to the concept of a path, this bridging idea, which is also... very much connected with the number six. You know, six is the idea of sixness is animation, right? In the opening slide, Blavatsky equated sixness with the animating or informing principle. And I think we have that personified in the swastika. Okay, other thoughts?
Ecclesia says, becomes a source of power, propelling forward into higher spheres of consciousness in a spiral motion.
I like that. That would be the evolutionary aspect of the swastika. Great thoughts, guys. This is good stuff. Other ideas as to the synthetic purpose? What about its place in an ordered manifesting plan?
Suzanne has some comments. She says, Shambhala, in the center where the will of God is known, there lies an essence of the perfected peace, a moving energy that has its essence in stillness.
I like that. Yeah, one can't help but think that this is as Martin said, the will of God, which originates on our planet in Shambhala, that this is, that is very related to the swastika. It's one of the appellations of the swastika is Thor's hammer, which has, kind of, the hammer has a pejorative quality. I mean, getting hit by Thor's hammer, but in fact, you can easily see that as an aspect of the will of God, right? So it's that which carries out the will of God. Okay, any more?
Nope, that's all I see for right now. Oh, wait, they're coming in. Julie says, the constant movement of the universe, not in its pralaya stage or not manifesting.
The constant motion of the universe and not in pralaya. One could say that the when that single ray drops into the mother deep, the radius, right, which is energetically related to the six through the side of the hexagon, that at that point the swastika is activated, and also it's it's related very much to the third principle in the sense of it's active and active intelligence. It's activated. It's a form of becoming and of progression through the cycles. Okay, anything else?
Anyone? Yes, I got a couple more. Helen says the informing principle in the manifested plan.
Mm-hmm. The informing principle in that. Yeah. It's for informing is I think, a very germane word for the swastika. Yeah.
And then Yogi says, reading Dina, page 248, number one, that the law of change governs the hierarchy just as it governs humanity. Number two, that the disciple who functions under this law has the following things to do. A, to deal with the constantly transforming changes in his own personality, and B, adapt himself to the rapidly developing and changing events which are taking place within the hierarchy.
Okay. Thank you. That's both within and without. Okay. Any other comments?
That's it.
All right. Some very good observations today. Thank you. Here's my thoughts on the synthetic purpose of the swastika. First of all, the dual motion of the swastika is both transcendent and immanent, for it is both inherent in the smallest particle of substance and a universal force to which all creation responds. The swastika, through the activity of Fohat, is the energetic means by which the formless realm descends into the realm of form, and evolutionally, on the reverse swastika, the means by which every discrete union of consciousness, through progressive recognition of the central point, becomes reunited with its monad. As HPB says, the swastika relates the seen to the unseen being represented by the central point of the swastika, the seen by the four arms, and by the movement of those arms, which represents that arena of activity called time and space. Okay. The final stage in DK's criteria for analyzing a symbol is identification with the quality and purpose of the symbol as it is illuminated by the mind held steady in the light. This final stage brings into activity the brain as well as the mind. So, let's attempt to identify with, rather than merely reflect on, the quality and purpose of the swastika. We'll take exactly 1 moment to do this, starting now. Okay, that's it for today. I hope you've enjoyed the webinar. Next month, we'll begin our survey of the number 7. For webinar number 20, that's the next one, we move to the next chapter in both The Key to the Universe and A Beginner's Guide to Constructing the Universe. DK tells us that the very first stanza and the stanzas of Sam in A Treatise on Cosmic Fire is descriptive of the motion of the swastika. So we use this short stanza today as our closing visualization. We'll begin and end with an Om. The secret of the fire lieth hid in the second letter of the sacred word. The mystery of life is concealed within the heart. When the lower point vibrates, when the sacred triangle glows, when the point, the middle center, and the apex connect and circulate the fire, when the threefold apex likewise burns, then the two triangles, the greater and the lesser, merge into one flame, which burneth up the whole. Ooh. Okay, that's it for today. Don't forget to donate a couple of bucks to the Moria Federation at moriafederation.com, which helps pay the yearly fee for the GoToMeeting account that makes these webinars possible. Thanks to Brett. These webinars are available on makara.us. Thank you, BL, for your continued and valuable assistance. Folks, keep spreading the word. As time passes and we move through these webinars, we get a natural attrition. And I hope that you will help me pump up the numbers. If you find these webinars useful, just right now pick a friend who might find these webinars interesting. And after the webinars, drop him or her an email. It may be then reminded just before the next webinar. It's any effort in that direction would be I'd be very grateful for. So thank you all for attending, and I hope to see you again next time. These webinars are always scheduled on the third Sunday of the month, but because there's a conflict with the full moon webinar on the third Sunday of February, our next webinar will be on the fourth Sunday, which happens to be February 28th. So, hope to see you then. Bye for now.
Goodbye, everybody.